I know that 8 years of systemic disenfranchisement, disinvestment, and incompetence had its desired effect on the electoral process in Georgia. The erosion of our democracy is not right.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Not just in Georgia.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, in Cottage Grove on KSO, in Eugene on KEPW, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, in Fayetteville, Arkansas on KPSQ, Seattle on KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day. On the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. David Roberts, our friend over at Vox.com, tweeted over the weekend, "Welp, they did it. The GOP disenfranchised enough Democratic voters to cheat their way to razor-thin victories in Florida and Georgia right in front of us with everyone watching." David said, "I expect that will only encourage them." Hard to disagree with that. Maybe you do. I don't. And what happened in Georgia and in Florida is a disgrace. We'll talk a little bit about that coming up in a bit. We have been covering the midterm election results and attempts to oversee the counting and assure it's actually accurate, which is no easy feat over the past 2 weeks since Election Day. We are not done yet. More news on elections and election results and the fight to oversee them and assure that every vote is counted somehow coming up today, with more races now called over the weekend here in California and, yes, in the great state of Florida. But I'd also like to hear from you today, if possible. I will be opening the phones a little bit later, if you want to line up right now. Our number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. What did the Democrats do right this past election? What did they do wrong? Any thoughts on that? And what would you like to see them do first when they take over their majority in the U.S. House in January? I'd love to hear your thoughts on all of that, as it's likely our last chance to get in some phone calls before the Thanksgiving Day holiday break coming up in just a few days. Police now say that the suspected gunman is dead at Mercy Hospital in Chicago. An officer and three others are in critical conditions condition following a shooting at that Chicago hospital. So, sadly, more of the same there. Before we get to elections here, we got to get to these California wildfires first, beginning with the continuing climate change fueled national catastrophe of these wildfires here in Southern California and Northern California, in particular in the northern part of the state. The numbers being reported by CAL FIRE officials continue, frankly, to be unfathomable. There are now 77 confirmed dead in the Northern California campfire alone. I believe another three died in Southern California. Is that confirmed at this time, Des? Was it three?
Right now, the only thing I have is that the Woolsey fire killed three people. So that holds steady. Yeah. And the Woolsey fire, now that is still burning west of Los Angeles, and more than 1,500 buildings have been completely destroyed. And as of Monday, it is more than 90% contained. But as you've mentioned, the campfire in Northern California, that's the one that stands at 77 dead.
And officials over the weekend said that something like 1,200 people now over the weekend were unaccounted for.
And that has now dropped to a bit over 990 people. So it's less than 1,000 people still missing. And Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey said that the reason for these numbers changing so much on the list of the unaccounted for is that officials are giving out the raw data that they're compiling from missing person reports, from calls, from reports, emails, social media, stuff like that, ever since the fire began on November 8th, and they are actually releasing that raw data, and that's why it changes so much. The list could also potentially contain duplicate names. There are lots of people that may not realize that they're on the list of the unaccounted for. So they're hoping that not all of those missing will be among the death toll.
Of course, I hope so as well. But even if a fraction of them, I mean, even if 10%, we're talking about another 100 dead. So I continue to hope somehow that these numbers are wildly wrong and that somehow CAL FIRE is just, in an abundance of caution, listing everything and everybody who has called in with a complaint. I can only hope, because these numbers are staggering. They're unfathomable. We're already at 77 in that campfire up north alone with, now, thankfully, 900 missing, but good Lord, we are talking about a lot of folks in this fire, which has so far charred some 236 square miles since November 8th. That was the totals that I've seen. I don't know if you have updated numbers on that.
That's about right. It's 65% contained as of Monday. Full containment is not expected until at least November 30th. Now, that's just containment. That's not putting the fire out. It could take another couple of months to put the campfire out.
Another couple of months?
Potentially. Potentially. I mean, these are difficult areas to get to. They're mountainous. There are a few roads to get to them, but containment is important. And now there is rain in the forecast. And, there's good news and bad news with the rain in the forecast. It will help damp down some of those flames. It's supposed to start as early as Tuesday night. They're expecting 4 to 6 inches in Northern California. That will help the fires, but it will also help the air quality. Because remember, the air quality in Northern California is horrible because of the fires. In some places, it has been measured as worse than the worst cities in China and India temporarily. So the smoke will hopefully be tamped down by the rain, but the rain will also bring a bigger risk of mudslides in these burn areas, and it's also going to make it more difficult to search for remains.
Donald Trump was in California over the weekend touring some of these sites. He toured the town of Paradise, 27,000 population there, which was burnt to the ground pretty much entirely. He referred to the town as Pleasure rather than Paradise.
It's like, you got one thing. Get the name right, at least.
Yeah, no kidding. He toured with Governor Jerry Brown and Governor-elect Gavin Newsom. And by the way, a lot of people thought that Brown and Newsom should not have met with Trump at all. I'm not sure I agree with that. But of course, if you have thoughts on that, we'll take them too in a little bit. 818-985-5735. Of course, Donald Trump continues to be a climate change denier, despite viewing the devastation in these fires up north. And was this... I think this was over the weekend.
Yes, this was on Saturday. This was him touring the actual devastation, the site itself in Paradise, California.
And here's this idiotic comment that Donald Trump had to say about these fires.
We've got to take care of the floors, the floors of the forests, very important. I was with the president of Finland, and he said, we have... are much different. We're a forest nation. He called it a forest nation. And they spend a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things, and they don't have any problem. And when it is, it's a very small problem.
So, Des, it's according to Trump this week or this day, it's now the fault for not raking. It's our fault for not raking in the forests like they do out in Finland?
No, it's just totally not true. Now, the New York Times actually asked the president of Finland what the hell Trump was talking about, and he was quite perplexed. He said he never said anything of the kind. He did, however, talk about how Finland manages its forests when he met with him over the over November 11th. In Paris, and that's not at all what he talked about. He talked about their forest management, as in they take the time and they have the funding to clear away dead trees. That's not something that the commercial logging industry is interested in. They're not interested in downed dead trees. They want the pretty live ones. So this was actually an opportunity for Trump to use our disaster and our tragedy in California to try to make some more inroads on lifting those protections for our forests so they can be opened up to commercial logging. I mean, that's what this is about.
So he took what the guy in Finland said and turned that into, we're not raking the forest floors.
Exactly. Of course, you know, I do want to say Finland is way colder than California, and they also get much more rain and snow than we get in California. So those are also kind of
fun. Reasons why they don't have quite as many problems with wildfires as we do.
Correct.
Ted Lieu, Congressman Ted Lieu from down here in Southern California, he responded. I think this was in response to Donald Trump's comments about raking the forest floor over the weekend.
It is unfortunate that we have a president that doesn't appear to believe in science. If preventing wildfires were as easy as raking leaves, we would have done that by now. But it is a very complicated issue. Climate change does play a large role. Decades ago, scientists predicted that because of climate change, we're going to have more extreme weather events. That's what we're seeing now. We have hotter weather, drier weather. In addition, we had some Santa Ana winds that also caused these fires to be more destructive. So I hope the president consults some experts, maybe talks to folks who actually know something about wildfires, and really stop believing these bizarre theories that he has.
Well, if he talks to his experts, so-called experts, they're going to tell him the same thing. Ryan Zinke, the head of the
Interior
thank you, Interior Department, was speaking on Wingnut Breitbart News on Sunday, said he didn't want to point any fingers, and then he went about blaming environmental radicals at the Sierra Club or something like that.
Is nonsense. Total nonsense.
Those are the experts, I guess, that Donald Trump would be talking to if he did bother to talk to anybody about this, instead of just, you know, turning on Fox News and finding out what those experts tell him. We'll be talking more about this, I suspect, in the coming days. The cause of these fires appears to have been sparked by electric lines, electric utility poles.
Yes.
Which are still not buried underground and continue to spark these type of fires all over California.
Now, let's just say it's under investigation. It has not been specifically officially named as the cause. However, Pacific Gas and Electric, the main utility that's up there, reported two electrical substations had problems moments before the fire started in the location of the fire. So we'll see what happens. PG&E was blamed for 17 of the fires that swept through Santa Rosa and Wine Country last year because their power lines were blown down by the wind, and then the fire spread very quickly. So they've already been said liable for those previous fires last year.
And that was a record fire last year, and now we have outdone last year's record again. And, you know, the idea that we have not buried the, hey, Donald Trump, you want a great infrastructure project? Bury every goddamn electric line in this entire country, California and all the other states. And we would go a long way at stopping these kind of fires, these various power outages that occur during our increasing storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, everything else. If you want a jobs program, if you want an infrastructure program, you could start right there, Mr. Trump. All right, let's take a quick break, and we will come back with, yes, the election continues. The counting continues. We are at the last or the near last of the races to be called from the November 8 midterm elections, but we got a couple other elections that are also coming up in a few days. I realize many folks have probably already forgotten about that, but no, we haven't. Not here, not on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Well, maybe. Close. Almost. We're almost there. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I want to try to get to some of your calls in a little bit at 818-985-5735. If you're listening live here in Southern California or anywhere else, 818-985-KPFK. What did the Democrats do right this year in the election? What did they do wrong in the 28 midterms as you see it? And what would you like to see as their to be their top priorities when the Democrats take over their new majority this January? 818-985-5735 is our phone number if you want to line up now. All right, over the weekend, after varying forms of what the state of Florida described as recounts, this is largely running the same hand-marked paper ballots back through the same computer tabulators that counted them in the first place, either correctly or incorrectly, who knows? And then, at least in the U.S. Senate race in Florida, examining the ballots that registered no vote at all when they were scanned by the computers, examining those by hand. Democrat Andrew Gillum officially conceded to Republican Congressman Ron DeSantis in the gubernatorial election in Florida over the weekend. He is said to have lost to DeSantis by 0.4%. That's 0.4 percentage point, according to the numbers after these very partial so-called recounts. And in the even closer U.S. Senate race in Florida, incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson has now conceded to Florida's termed-out Republican Governor Rick Scott in a race that Scott reportedly won by 0.12%, just over 0.1%. That's 10,033 votes as of last tally out of more than 8 million counted by the computers and that limited hand count across the state of Florida. So a few weeks ago, just after election night, when media began reporting that Gillum and Nelson appeared to have lost in the state of Florida, despite Democrats doing so well in so many other states and doing so well in this referendum to re-enfranchise former felons in the state of Florida. Just after that, I posed the question, well, what's the matter with Florida? That question may need a very long answer and more time than we have on this show, at least today. But our friend Ari Berman cuts to the heart of the matter in a report this month for the latest Mother Jones. He writes that in 2007, then Republican Florida Governor Charlie Crist, who later became a Democrat, instituted a change that automatically restored voting rights to certain nonviolent ex-felons. But in 2011, Rick Scott, his successor, when he came in and replaced Governor Crist, he reversed the governor's policy, the previous Republican governor's policy, and made the law against former nonviolent ex-felons, made that law even harsher. Now, people with felony records have to wait 5 to 7 years before they could petition the clemency board that was helmed by Governor Scott and three other Republican officials in order to restore their voting rights. Under Scott, Berman notes, 90% of ex-felons have had their applications denied. Again, ex-felons, people who have already served their time. 90% of them, after waiting all of those years and applying to get their voting rights back, their applications were denied. Only 3,000 people have seen their rights restored during Governor Rick Scott's 8 years as governor. Just 3,000 people, that compared with 155,000 under Charlie Crist. And under his Republican predecessor, Republican Jeb Bush, 75,000 had their voting rights restored. But under Crist, 3,000 in those 8 years. Because of the long backlog, the wait time to get even a hearing before the governor and this clemency board, that time, you would have to wait more than a decade, as the Florida law had been up until November 6th. In February of this year, a federal judge called the system crushingly restrictive, said it needed to be reformed. In 2016, Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in Florida by 113 votes. And yet, there are 500,000 African-Americans who were unable to vote in 2016, thanks to Scott's restrictions on voting rights for former felons. African-Americans who did vote in Florida favored Clinton by a 76-point margin. Well, over the weekend, that was Ari from the upcoming Mother Jones issue. Over the weekend, Ari Berman tweeted that Rick Scott won his Senate race by 10,000 votes, and yet 1.7 million people overall, including 500,000 African-Americans, were disenfranchised in Florida in 2018. He says Scott only restored the voting rights to 3,000 people, twice as many whites as blacks, he notes, and adds, this is how Scott won. How he won a U.S. Senate seat for the next 6 years, and how Ron DeSantis won the governor's mansion for the next 4 years. It is hard to argue with that. Now, the good news is that Florida voters, by about 65%, voted to approve a constitutional ballot measure that will now re-enfranchise these former felons. So it's a bit surprising, in truth, that Nelson and Gillum were reported to have not won their races based on the computer tally of votes in that constitutional ballot measure, in any event. But now that has passed, yet with a Republican back in control in Florida as governor, rumors are already coming out that he plans to bollocks up that constitutional amendment with legislation somehow. So that disenfranchisement could continue. We will continue to watch it closely here, since it may be the only way that Republicans can win the state in 2020 is if they continue to keep these 1.7 million people from being able to cast a vote at all. Meanwhile, over the weekend in Broward County, Florida, the supervisor of elections there, Brenda Snipes, who has faced national scrutiny in recent days for her county's chaotic performance during the so-called recount in Florida, she resigned on Sunday. Snipes had served as Broward Supervisor of Elections for 15 years after being appointed by then-Governor Jeb Bush back in 2003. And I've heard a lot of folks complaining that somehow Snipes was doing something wrong, committing some sort of fraud on behalf of Democrats. Little reminder here. She was appointed by the Republican Governor Jeb Bush. Her county's performance during the most recent recount, which was delayed by faulty machines, missing ballots, had prompted Governor Rick Scott to make completely unsubstantiated allegations of fraud by Snipes. That, of course, nonetheless, she has been a terrible supervisor of elections out there for many years. And her county's recent performance in these so-called recounts is just the latest in a string of mismanaged election issues in Broward, as she has been the supervisor there. Most notably, Snipes was justifiably widely criticized for destroying ballots after the 2016 election 10 months earlier than the federal requirement. You're supposed to keep ballots for 22 months after any federal election. A circuit judge ruled that Snipes' office had violated both state and federal laws by destroying those ballots just 12 months instead of 22 months after the election. She kept what she says are the digital ballot images from those ballots, the scans from those ballots. She says she kept those, but not the ballots themselves. So, yeah, she has been a disaster in her 15 years since being appointed by a Republican in the Democratic-leaning Broward County. Few will be sad to see her go, frankly, though claims that she was committing fraud are overwrought at best, based on the evidence that we have right now. Anyway, she was harassed by Republicans over the past couple of weeks, thanks to folks like Rick Scott and, yes, the president of the United States, claiming that she was somehow stealing the election for Democrats. Apparently she didn't. But the claims, the calls with no evidence whatsoever were appalling. And while I'm happy to see Snipes go in Broward, frankly, there may be other Florida supervisors of election now, based on what I am hearing from some folks in Florida, who may end up stepping down as well or not running again for the supervisor of elections post just because of the harassment that has become unbearable. For some of them. And frankly, that would be a real shame if that happened. Kristen Clark, president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Voting Under Civil Rights, for civil rights under law, made a statement over the weekend in response to the conclusion of the electoral races in both Georgia and Florida. She said that the scars and battle wounds from this election season make clear that voter suppression is rampant and unchecked. At every turn, we encountered voter suppression across Georgia and Florida aimed squarely at African Americans, Latinos, and other voters of color. While contested races come to a close, says Ms. Clark, we know that there are many who were disenfranchised and locked out. Because of malfeasance in some communities and gross negligence in others. In Georgia, she says, we fought officials who found reasons to reject ballots of minority voters at higher rates, purged the registration rolls, consolidated polling sites, and took other action directed at the state's voters of color. In Florida, we fought racist robocalls, discriminatory signature match verification procedures, unprocessed mail ballots and others and other rules intended to silence Black and Latino voters. She notes, as the dust settles, Congress must make restoration of the Voting Rights Act and election reform its highest priority in the new year. This election season stands as powerful evidence of the corrosive effect of voter suppression in our democracy today. Nowhere was that suppression clearer than what we saw in the state of Georgia. On Friday's broadcast, we played some of Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams' announcement that there was no viable legal path for her to be able to defeat Georgia's Republican Secretary of State and champion vote suppressor Brian Kemp in her very close contest to become the next governor of the Peach State. There was nowhere to go. There just weren't enough votes out there, thanks to voter purges, rejected absentee and provisional ballots, and yes, the state's 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, which can never, ever be audited in any way to determine if they accurately reflect the voters' intent. Much as we've been warning about on this show for more years than I care to remember. Stacey Abrams announced the formation of a new organization on Friday called Fair Fight Georgia, vowing a federal lawsuit in the coming days against the gross mismanagement of the election by Kemp, which she has not conceded because she said conceding would be to acknowledge that something was done, correctly and accurately and truly, which she cannot. Good for her. All of that gross mismanagement she refers to resulted in massive suppression, and what I had been warning about for weeks could not possibly be seen as a legitimate election, a legitimate result, if Kemp ended up winning under these conditions. In the final certified results, Kemp has avoided a December runoff against Stacey Abrams by just 0.22%, less than a quarter of one percentage point. Out of about 4 million votes cast after Brian Kemp had purged some 1.5 million voters from the rolls, after he had put 53,000 registrations on hold, after he had closed more than 200 polling places. leading to 4.5 hour lines to vote in some places. 4.5 hours. And after Kemp falsely accused Democrats of cybercrimes just days before the election, before his own election, which he oversaw as Secretary of State. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, as we discussed on Friday, called the election stolen. And he's hardly the only one questioning the legitimacy of Kemp's win as governor in the state of Florida. Over the weekend, former U.S. ambassador to the Czech Republic, Norm Eisen, who is now CEO of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, he tweeted over the weekend referring to the massive voter suppression in Georgia by saying, quote, "I was a U.S. ambassador. If my host country had attacked democracy in this way, I would have publicly slammed them and called for economic sanctions against them. I certainly would not have treated the quote-unquote winning candidate as a normal head of the state, and we should not do so here." Talking about Brian Kemp, the new, soon-to-be the new head of state in the state of Georgia. On Friday, in her announcement, Abrams said, "I acknowledge that former Secretary of State Brian Kemp will be certified as the victor in the 2018 gubernatorial elections, but to watch an elected official who claims to be represent the people of this state baldly pin his hopes for an election on the suppression of the people's democratic right to vote has been truly appalling," she said. Again, hard to argue with that. But in some more encouraging news for voters, as the ballots are, yes, still being tallied out here and or in California and challenged in several states, including New York, Utah, yes, Georgia. There's still an undecided House race there, U.S. House race. And yes, out here in California, Democratic candidate Gil Cisneros captured a Republican-held U.S. House seat in Southern California, capping a Democratic rout over the weekend, in which the party picked up 6 congressional seats from Republicans in this state. In what had been the last undecided House contest in California, Cisneros, according to AP's call, beat Republican Young Kim for the state's 39th congressional district. The Cisneros victory over the weekend cements a stunning political realignment in the state that will leave a vast stretch of the L.A. metropolitan area under Democratic control in the U.S. House. With Kim's defeat, 4 Republican-held House districts, all or partly in Orange County, once nationally known as a GOP stronghold, 4 Republican House seats will have shifted in one single election to the Democrats. That change means that the county, which is Richard Nixon's birthplace, site of his presidential library, formerly known as Reagan Country, Orange County will have only Democrats now representing them in Washington, D.C. next year. The Orange County Democratic Party said it is the first time since 1940 that all 7 House seats in the county, home to 3.2 million people, the first time since 1940 that all of those seats are in Democratic control. Democrats also recently picked up the last Republican House seat anchored in L.A. County when Democrat Katie Hill ousted Republican Congressman Steve Knight. The GOP also lost the seat up in the Central Valley, the agricultural Central Valley. So with other gains now, Democrats, all told here, Democrats will hold a 45-8 edge, 45-8 in the U.S. House, in the California U.S. House delegation next year. And again, as I've been talking about over the past few days on the show, that is without partisan gerrymandering here in California. Our districts are determined by an independent commission. Despite Democratic control of the governor's mansion and the state legislature, this is all done independently. So when you hear this 45-8 advantage by by Democrats in the U.S. House delegation, it is not because the seats have been essentially stolen from them by Democrats, the way we have seen in states around the country where Republicans are in control and have done these extreme partisan gerrymanders. Cisneros, who won this final uncalled race, is a 47-year-old. He's a lottery jackpot winner. He won $266 million in the lottery jackpot.
Sounds pretty nice. Sounds I would take that.
Right? Yeah. If you took it, would you then run for Congress?
You know, that's an interesting question. I just might do that. But I wouldn't run against my own Congressman, Adam Schiff. I like him.
Not me. I'd be retiring to the Barbados or something. I'm exhausted. So, of course, I have to win the. I have to play the lottery to actually win it.
Yeah, I'm told you can't win if you don't play. It's a minor detail.
That's what I hear. Cisneros was a first-time candidate here. He described his interest in Congress as an extension of his time in the military, saying it was about public service. He runs a charitable foundation with his wife. On health care, he talked about his mother, who went without insurance for 16 years. Saying that should just not happen in this country. Democrats are on track to hold every single statewide office in California. Again, the party holds a supermajority in both chambers of the legislature and has a more than 3.5 million vote advantage in voter registration. Republicans are in trouble out here in California unless Democrats screw it up. In any event, that puts the Democrat, which they're very good at, by the way, the Democratic pickup now in the U.S. House is at 37 seats, with one more race in New York leaning towards the Democrats. There also leans towards Republicans, another undecided race in New York. There are also two uncalled House races, one in Utah and, yes, one in Georgia. But it means the Democrats will have a net gain of at least 37 seats in a rout that blows away their last blue wave back in 2006 during the disastrous presidency of George W. Bush. So what would you like to see them do? With that majority, with that new House majority in January, I'd love to hear from you. 818-985-5735. What would you like to see as the first thing Democrats do? 818-985-KPFK. I got a few more stories here. Let me do one, and then we'll come back with your calls and some other thoughts here. Because this is a big one. Democrat Katie Hobbs, she declared victory late on Friday in the race for Arizona Secretary of State. 10 days after the AP had initially, and yes, wrongly apparently, called the race for her opponent, Republican Steve Gaynor. Because apparently they just could not wait for all the votes to be counted out there in Arizona before declaring a winner for some reason. When they did so on election night, there were still nearly a million ballots uncounted across the state of Arizona. There's still several, about 70,000 ballots that are still to be processed. But on Friday, Hobbs was leading with more than 15,000 votes, and that lead was still climbing, the Democrat Hobbs. In her statement, she said, as Secretary of State, I will work to ensure that every eligible voter, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green, Libertarian, can cast your ballot with the confidence that your vote counts and your voice matters, and do so in a way that is meaningful and convenient for you, she promises. Well, that would be a nice change of pace for many voters in the state of Arizona, if true, if she follows through with that. Republican Governor Doug Ducey called her to congratulate her on Friday afternoon before she declared victory. And then shortly afterwards, she received a call from Steve Gaynor, the Republican vying for Secretary of State there in Arizona. So in winning this race, Hobbs will be yet another Democrat who won a tightly contested statewide race in what had historically been red Arizona. Last Monday, you'll recall, Republican Martha McSally conceded for the race for U.S. Senate to Democrat Kyrsten Sinema. That was a pickup from the Republican Jeff Flake. The night before, Democrat Kathy Hoffman in Arizona declared victory over Republican Frank Riggs in the race for Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, the school superintendent there. So, yes, Arizona now finally seems to be turning blue to some extent. Thank you, Mr. Trump. Great job. This is huge news for Arizona before the 2020 presidential election, particularly having a Democratic Secretary of State there. Hopefully everyone knows, after seeing what happened in Georgia this year under Secretary of State Brian Kemp, how a state's chief election official can essentially steal an election if they put their mind to it. So even as election tallies wrap up from November 6, please note there are some outstanding runoff elections still to come. One of them is in Georgia. Yes, in the Secretary of State's race, where Democratic Congressman John Barrow is facing Republican State Rep Brad Raffensperger. After neither got more than 50% of the vote on November 6th, but somehow Secretary of State Brian Kemp managed to do that just barely. Anyway, hopefully Georgians now appreciate the importance of the elected role of the Secretary of State and can somehow overcome voter suppression that is still in place in Georgia, thanks to Kemp, in order to elect a Democrat there. But we'll see. As you may imagine, we will be watching that closely in the days and weeks ahead, since the 2020 presidential race may all come down to Georgia, as far as I know. All right, quick break here, back with your calls and some more election news, if I have time. 818-985-5735. I'd be just as happy to talk to you if you want to call. 818-985-KPFK. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. The Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, taking your calls on the midterm elections or anything else you want to talk about, including those fires up in Northern California. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Do I want to hit any of these first? We'll see. Let's get to the calls first. What did Democrats do right in this election? What did they do wrong in the 2018 midterms? Love to hear from you. 818-985-5735. And what would you like to see them do first? Let's go to Mohammed in Chino. Welcome to the Bradcast, Mohammed. Hoping you're clear of the fires nearby in Chino.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Brad. Love the show. I'm in Chino, so we don't have anything immediately bothering us. But I wanted to make a comment. Because a lot of times when people are talking about the Republicans versus the Democrats, they have the image of Republicans as we know them today from, like, you know, the 70s and 80s on, as being anti, you know, civil rights and all that kind of stuff. But what most people don't remember is the Democrats used to be the Republicans and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Like from the time of Lincoln up until, you know, like they say, the 40s or something, when the Democrats won.
Well, actually, until the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1965, and they sort of switched. Yeah.
That was the switch, basically, where what became cemented into the public, you know, persona of Democrats versus Republicans. Before it was the Dixiecrats, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So that's the one issue, because, like, a lot of times they'll make some statement about, oh, it's been 40 years since this. And I'm like, well, really, you can't count it from that time or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And
I appreciate that thought, because you're absolutely right. And the way the corporate media tends to cover Republicans, it is as if they were still this generally this moderate party, fiscal conservatives. They are not fiscal conservatives. Family values Republicans. They are not family values Republicans, as you can see who they elected and how they govern. I've been yelling and screaming about the way the corporate media has been misreporting on what has come of the Republican Party over the past, I would say, 10 or 20 years at this point. So thanks for...
I often wonder if it's that myopia of modern-day young newscasters who don't know their history.
You know what? I don't know. I think it has to do with more the corporations who are behind these big companies, and the idea that if you report these facts as truth, if you call out someone as a liar, if you point out that, you know, it's under Republican control of the White House, jobs go down, the deficit goes up, all of the things that Republicans pretend. If you point those things out, you're being a partisan. You know, I pointed them out for years and people accused me of being a Democrat. I'm not a Democrat. I'm just telling the truth. So,
sure. You know, there's one more point I wanted to make, which was like you asked the question, what did the Democrats do wrong and all that, right? So my issue was began with Bernie Sanders when the Democratic Party sandbagged him and just to support Hillary, right? And they've done that down the line for any progressive. And you can see that the way the progressives won in large numbers was against the Democratic will of the party.
Against the establishment, the conservative blue dogs, the DCCC. You saw a lot of progressive Democrats, young progressive Democrats stepping up. And guess what? They are changing the party. They're pushing those folks out, and to me, that's the way you do it, democracy.
It's new blood. I mean, just that picture of all of the new Democratic House of Representatives, House Representatives look like a United Nations as opposed to the GOP picture.
Yeah, no, word of warning to our listeners, if you're going to look at that GOP picture, make sure you have sunglasses on first. You may need them. Hey, thanks, Mohammed. I appreciate the call, brother. Hang in there. Stay safe. Let me go to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hey, GS, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, Brad. I used to do volunteer work at KPFK. You know, your last comment makes me laugh. Democracy, what a concept.
Yeah.
Paraphrasing Robin Williams.
Yeah.
My basic observation here is I understand that states get to determine their own voting procedures, practices, probably equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But why can't there be federal standards for voting machines, et cetera, where the different states under public pressure will have to indicate whether they support the federal standards or not? That's my question.
Well, we actually do have federal standards, but they're voluntary standards. They're put in place by the Election Assistance Commission. They're voluntary. There are certain things that courts have determined that the federal government can do when it comes to elections, certain requirements. But when it comes to voting systems, the standards are terrible to begin with, even if you followed the standards. And by the way, we don't even follow them here in California anymore. Our Democratic Secretary of State decided we don't need to follow the standards, the federal standards anymore here in California. Most states don't follow those standards. They're crappy standards to begin with. And, you know, at best right now, we're seeing a push by a lot of Democrats to require a paper ballot for every vote cast, but they're not demanding a hand count. They're not demanding a hand marked paper ballot. So, like what we're about to get here in Los Angeles, largest voting jurisdiction in the nation, we are about to get touchscreen computers that will print out computer marked paper ballots, not hand marked paper ballots. So it'll be 100% impossible to know, to verify any of those ballots as having been cast by the actual voter after the election. So, got to keep the pressure on, brother. That's all I can say. It's maddening.
Thank you.
Thanks, GS. I do appreciate that call. Hey, it's our old friend Mo. I haven't heard from Morris in a while up in Long Beach. Hey, Morris, welcome to the broadcast, sir. How you doing?
Brad, I'm doing real good, Brad. Thanks for asking. I just wanted to answer your questions. What is it that the Democrats did right this past election cycle? Well, they weren't Trump. And also, what is it that the Democrats need to do with the second question? Well, the Democrats need to be Democrats. I didn't say the corporate Democrats. They need to be the indigenous Democrats. You know, we talk about Republicans and Democrats. Check this out. Here in California, it was a Democrat that held up health care for everybody in the state of California. I think his name is Rendon. He got a total of $700,000. I can't even count that much. $700,000 from the pharmaceutical industry not to allow that legislation to come to the come to the floor. Now, when Obama was the president,
you're talking about just to clarify, Mo, you're talking about the single payer bill that had passed, I think, in the state California State Senate, but not in the House, but was blocked by the Democratic leader in the House, or vice versa. It might have been in the Senate.
That, Brad, you're on top of everything, aren't you, Brad? At least if it relates to this kind of stuff, you're on top of it. Now, when Obama was the president, Mr. Obama was the president, he had a Democratic Congress for about 75 days. You know what? Those guys, they messed around and they lost it. They didn't act right. If you allow the corporate Democrats to take over this party as opposed to the indigenous Democrats, we're going to have a problem. I'm talking about Booker, Harris, Clinton, Biden. If those are the voices that you see on MSNBC and CNN, we can lose it to the Republicans. All they got to do is just sit tight for a while because the corporate Democrats are going to take us down faster than anything else. All they got to do is get out the way and allow the people, the will of the people, to come to pass, and they can stay in power forever. Thanks, Brett.
Thanks, Mo. I appreciate the call, brother. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Let's see. Do I have got my papers all confused here. One thing I haven't talked about, by the way, coming up is, yes, as I said, new elections coming up. I mentioned that runoff coming up in Georgia, December 4. Well, we have an election for the U.S. Senate coming up just next week on November 27. This is a runoff in Mississippi just days after Thanksgiving for the U.S. Senate in Mississippi. This is a runoff in the special election to fill the seat vacated by the ailing Thad Cochran earlier this year. Mississippi's Republican governor had appointed Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith to temporarily fill that seat, but a special election was required. That was held on November 6, and the top two vote-getters in that race were Hyde-Smith and former Democratic Congressman and Agricultural Secretary Mike Espy. And they will be facing off on November 27. Now, this is Mississippi, so it's very Republican in general. But you know what? So was the state of Alabama until Democrat Doug Ducey won his special election for the U.S. Senate against right-wing nut Roy Moore last year. Now, Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, she has been facing a barrage of criticism after the publication of a video on November 11, in which she discussed attending a lynching, telling a small crowd on November 2 about someone or another saying, quote, "If he invited me to a public lynching, I'd be in the front row." So that's a disturbing statement in Mississippi, of all places, given their history of lynching and murdering, yes, murdering voting rights advocates in Mississippi. And then a few nights ago, another video also from early November, I think this was from November 3rd, while Hyde-Smith was campaigning in Starkville, which is home of Mississippi State University. Some video was published in which Hyde-Smith is talking about voter suppression with what appears to be a group of students outside her campaign bus. The audio is difficult to hear without subtitles on the radio, so I can't play it for you. But she says to the group outside the campaign bus, she says, quote, "And then they remind me that there's a lot of liberal folks in those other schools who that maybe we don't want to vote. Maybe we want to make it just a little more difficult. And I think that's a great idea," she said, in Mississippi, with its history of disenfranchisement of voters. Now, as usual, when Republicans get caught saying stuff like that, Hyde-Smith is now claiming that she was just joking. But yeah, hilarious stuff, joking about lynching and making it more difficult for those liberal folks to vote in Mississippi. Especially, by the way, while she is running against a man who would be the state's first African-American U.S. Senator since Reconstruction. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. By the way, you can also tweet me. I am the Brad Blog on the Twitters. Kofeve Lepew tweets in to say, "I can still remember when Republicans didn't have to cheat to win." Let's go to, Jonathan in Oxnard. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the Bradcast.
Hey, glad to talk to you. I've got two things about the fires.
Oh, okay.
First of all, if pigs are smart enough to build their houses out of bricks, it's time that, you know, Malibu keeps burning down and building up. We got to build the houses out of concrete and bricks. Mm. And they're durable during the fires. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. If you can't, if you can't beat them, join them or whatever.
All right.
Second thing is dry ice particles. This should be used to put out the fires, or to be small amounts of dry ice can be spread over a house and it can keep it from being burned.
Really?
And they can be dropped from helicopters.
Okay. Never heard of that.
Check out EarthGuard on the YouTube. Right. There's a whole demonstration how it puts out oil fires.
All right.
And regular fires.
All right,
and
thanks.
It's also good for oil spills also.
Thanks, Jonathan. Never heard of that. Hope Jonathan doesn't work with big dry ice. That might be. All right. Appreciate that call. Let me very quickly, I'm going to try to get in a few more if I can. Got to be quick about it. Hey, Murray, welcome to the broadcast from Warner Springs. That's California?
Yes. Yeah, that's California, down next to Temecula.
Ah.
And I was just hoping that we could get the word out there that we need to move some of this focus off and of outrage off of Trump into getting some term limits set on these senators that have been there for since they were born, it seems like.
Why do we need term limits? Why don't we just vote them out?
Well, because it doesn't happen. I mean, once they get enough, you know, the longer they've been in there,
yeah,
the more connections they make, the more corporations they seem to be sponsored by.
Yeah.
And then they're able to advertise their themselves all over the state. And a lot of people, they see a sign that says somebody's name on it,
yeah,
everywhere, and that's who they vote for.
I hear you, Murray. So, I'm going to cut you short only because I got to get out here momentarily. But a better idea than getting rid of them because they got all of that corporate sponsorship. How about let's get rid of the corporate sponsorship in the first place so we can have a fair fight in these elections?
As long as money is a form of free speech,
yeah,
you know, we're going to have problems.
Okay. I'm not so sure about that. I think we can get corporate money out of our politics. But I do take your point, Murray. I'm just not sure, yeah, I agree with term limits. Thanks, brother. I got to get out of here.
Day.
You bet. You too. Do I have time? I really don't. I got to get out. I'm sorry, everyone. I couldn't get to on the phone lines. Thank you for calling in. Sorry I couldn't get to everybody. But we will be back with you again, tomorrow on the broadcast. I hope you will join me for that. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator, Gary Baca, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. That is it. Until we meet again tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.